It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, conservative writer Fred Barnes is with us to share his thoughts on the opening days of the Donald Trump presidency.
First, the acting Attorney General of the United States, Sally Yates, was fired by President Trump last night. The move came after she announced that the Department of Justice would not defend Trump's executive order barring immigrants and refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States.
The White House said in a statement that Yates had, quote, betrayed, end quote, the Department of Justice by not following the order and was replaced immediately.
Javed Kalim is with us. He's the national race and justice reporter for the LA Times, and he's been covering this story. Javed, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did the White House say about why Sally Yates, acting attorney general, was fired last night?
Well, they released a very unusual statement, but a lot of things happening these days are not in the typical fashion, where they said that she betrayed the president. And the Department of Justice and her job. And so late last night, she got a handwritten letter telling her from the White House that she was fired. And around midnight, she packed up and left.
Can you give us a little background on Sally Yates? She was a holdover, as I understand it, from the Obama administration.
Yes, she's been, you know, she's had a long career as a prosecutor, and was a relative newcomer to D.C. She was the deputy attorney general under the then AG Loretta Lynch under Obama. And, you know, she spent most of her career in Georgia as a prosecutor and appointed under both Democratic and Republican leaders. So she's worked, you know, with various kinds of people and when she was confirmed by the Senate for her position in the Department of Justice, she was actually hailed by people on both parties for kind of being a straight shooter and somebody who was an independent thinker, and was actually asked during her confirmation, you know, if she would stand up to the president if she would be asked to do something illegal.
And we have a bit of that recording from her confirmation hearing. Here's what happened.
You have to watch out because people will be asking you to do things you just need to say no about. Do you think the attorney general has a responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper? A lot of people have defended the Lynch nomination, for example, by saying, well, he appoints somebody who's going to execute his views. What's wrong with that? But if the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the attorney general or the deputy attorney general say no?
Senator, I believe that the attorney general or the deputy attorney general has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
Interesting exchange there. That's from 2015 as Sally Yates was being questioned by Senator Jeff Sessions, who is Trump's pick for attorney general. What do you hear in that particular bit of conversation as it sounds today in 2017?
It's almost like she was, she was actually the that context there was that Senator Sessions was asking her about an Obama order on immigration that Republicans were not happy with. But it's almost like she was foreshadowing what she believed was her position yesterday, which she basically said that she does not believe the Department of Justice can defend or honor this executive order on immigration and refugees, that she does not believe that they can defend it as legal.
Do we know whether she was briefed or informed about the pending executive order before it went public?
Well, the Department of Justice was. They have an Office of Legal Counsel, which is supposed to review these kinds of orders to make sure they, you know, at their minimum, pass the test of a legal challenge. And so that office, which was under then Attorney General Yates, did review, I'm told, very briefly, the executive order. But in her statement, which she released to her attorneys, whose jobs were to defend this new rule by President Trump, since he's getting sued for it left and right, she said that it wasn't just the new rules in refugees and immigrants that she could not defend, but she cited in a vague way, statements by the president and his associates about these new rules that basically have suggested that it's targeted at Muslims.
Javed Khalim is with us right now. He's the national race and justice reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And we're talking about President Trump's decision to fire Acting Attorney General Sally Yates after she said she would not enforce President Trump's immigration ban. And Javed, is the firing that we saw last night, is this typical of what you would normally see in a transition or might see in a transition, or was this somehow outside of established norms?
Well, on one hand, Yates was not going to be in that position for long. She was just a temporary kind of placeholder, and she knew that. The president is waiting for his nominee, Senator Sessions, to be Attorney General, and that vote at this point is going to happen tomorrow on the Judiciary Committee. So that's her short-lived status as Attorney General is typical, but the way in which she was fired, rather quickly and replaced, and told that she was betraying the administration, that is highly unusual. The last time that really happened, and it was a little different, was in 1973 when the Attorney General and the deputy under Nixon resigned.
But is it in the realm of recent history for attorneys general to disagree with the White House, to part ways with them on laws or ideology and how it might play out in law?
Well, according to Yates, that's the job. In her confirmation hearing, that she said, I should get independent legal counsel. According to what we can read into the Trump White House, they've released statements via their press secretary, Sean Spicer, which says, these are presidential appointees who should be leading these offices, and they should be on board with the president's plan.
And on the other hand, is it what you would expect from a president, incoming or otherwise, to want an attorney general who agrees with the legislation he's putting in place, executive orders, and is ready to defend those orders?
Yes, I think, for example, it's fairly certain that if and when Senator Sessions becomes attorney general, he will defend President Trump's executive orders and other positions. This was an unusual case because we're kind of in a middle zone right now still. It's a bizarre set of circumstances. It was a banner headline in our newspaper today, which we don't do very often, but I've been doing all week because we have had a lot of unusual news and things are working different than they used to.
Is there any expectation that what happened with Sally Yates could influence Senator Sessions' confirmation to be Attorney General?
I think it already has. Today, at the Capitol, Democratic senators, which I believe were supposed to vote today on Sessions, talked and brought up this incident with Yates several times. Senator Dick Durbin, especially, hammered on this, and this issue of the executive order was not an issue when Senator Sessions was first brought up for his hearing, because it hadn't been signed yet. But now, with this flap, it's become an issue.
Is this something that for Democrats will just be holding up the confirmation? Are they wanting to make their voices heard, or is there an expectation that there could be real resistance that could block the confirmation of Sessions?
Right now it's looking like he'll be confirmed, but they're trying to buy their time, and they're trying to make a statement. And their focus is, I think, on trying to block other nominees at this moment.
Javed, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Javed Kalim, national race and justice reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And he joined us to talk about President Trump's decision to fire acting Attorney General Sally Yates after she announced the Department of Justice would not enforce his administration's immigration ban.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up with refugee policy in the news, our guest looks at the numbers of refugees here in Wisconsin and where they came from.
Right now, it's been a busy week and a half for the new presidential administration with confirmation hearings, executive orders and memoranda, and a steady stream of presidential tweets.
And there's been backlash with protests after the inauguration and in reaction to immigration and refugee changes and a Democratic walkout on some key committee hearings for cabinet appointees.
Fred Barnes joins us now for a look at the opening days of the Trump presidency. He is executive editor of the Weekly Standard. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
A lot going on, Fred, but big picture, your thoughts on the Trump administration so far?
Well, I think he's doing okay. Not great. He's certainly moving at a very fast speed. I remember when Reagan didn't get to his first serious action until the eighth day. Trump had already done, he'd gotten rid of a trade treaty, done stuff on immigration, he'd done all kinds of things by his eighth day. He's made a couple of mistakes. I think the one that is the most damaging mistake is not this refugee thing, a suspension of letting refugees in for 120 days. The problem is Mexico. He has to get along with Mexico. He needs to have an ally in the Mexican president. Mexico's not going to move away. And so by getting in a fight unnecessarily over this question of who's going to pay for the wall, I think Trump's made a mistake on that. And, of course, there's a big flap over this suspension of refugees coming in for, 3 months?
Now, you recently wrote that Democrats could actually have more room for cooperation with President Trump than they would with a more traditional conservative Republican. Today, we're seeing this boycott of a couple of the confirmation hearings. Tom Price at Health and Human Services, Seth Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary. They're worried about some of the ethics information they've seen or don't have. What do you make of the Democratic reaction? A missed opportunity, it seems like you'd say.
Yeah, well, no, I think I'll withdraw that prediction. It doesn't look very good at the moment. Now, one of the things, of course, is infrastructure. Trump wants to spend $1 trillion, and Democrats want to spend $1 trillion, not all in 1 year. I think they'll come together on that because it serves the interest of both of them. But for the moment, Democrats are having a fit and doing things like boycotting a vote on a cabinet member that they know is going to pass. And it just, I mean, this is just, you know, harassment. It's annoying to Republicans. And you know, I guess in a few days they'll show up and they'll vote for Tom Price as the HHS secretary. And I forget who the other one is, but that one will probably pass, too.
You described in a recent piece Donald Trump as a big government conservative, which is kind of a new category. How is this going to work as he relates with small government conservatives in Congress?
Well, it's not going to work very well. I think there's a rub there. Paul Ryan's a good example of, I think, a small government conservative, somebody who is believes in letting the free market do as much as it can. Trump obviously has intervened in the free market with his efforts to jawbone American corporations and keep them from sending jobs out of Mexico or overseas. But the other thing is that Trump, you know, is not a free trader. And most Republicans are free traders. Now, this Trans-Pacific treaty wasn't a very good one, wasn't negotiated very well, and so I don't think anybody's in the U.S. anyway is particularly sorry to see it go, but there's going to be a rub there. When Trump talks about, you know, he's going to charge Mexico 20% a tariff for anything they send in the United States, I think he's going to run into trouble on that. And then you have the economic package with tax cuts in it, and we'll see how they come down. But it's on the economy, and Trump is not a small government conservative. He's not like most Republicans. When I say big government conservative, what I mean is somebody who is basically conservative but believes in big projects. I mean, think of all the things that Trump wants to spend on infrastructure, a new space program, a program of expanded medical research, a huge military buildup. That's big government stuff.
Yeah, how do you see that going? Is Congress going to provide the funding for all that new spending that the president wants?
Well, here is something that for a good bit of it, you know, Democrats would like to spend it, but it's going to be Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, who are going to balk in that. And I suspect Trump will have to cut back on what he wants, on how much he wants to spend, perhaps spread it over more years. But, you know, look, he's the president. And he's going to spend more than, say, George W. Bush did, at least initially, or Ronald Reagan did.
One place where he may be more in line with congressional Republicans is regulatory reform. He's talked about this and for one department anyway, a two-for-one rule. You want one new regulation, you got to cut two, maybe big cutbacks coming in EPA staff. Where do you see that going?
Well, I don't know. This rule, you know, two-for-one, I mean, that... I don't see that happening very well. You have to go after specific rules, specific regulations that you don't like, and get rid of them. And you're going to get rid of, the two-for-one thing doesn't work. You have to be a lot more specific. Some places you're not going to want to cut a lot of rules. Others you're going to want to cut a lot. So, they need to get specific, and they will. I mean, look, when they get their cabinet members in, and the one that I'm most interested in watching is Scott Pruitt, the Oklahoma Attorney General who's been nominated to head the Environmental Protection Agency. He sued that agency a number of times. I know he wants to get rid of a lot of their regulations, and I want to see what happens when he tries.
Talking to Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard. He's sharing his thoughts on the first 10-plus now days of the Donald Trump presidency. Max Boot, who sometimes has written for the Weekly Standard over the years,
sure.
New piece in Foreign Policy, very worried, he says, about foreign policy so far in the Trump administration, the role of Stephen Bannon, political strategist now in the Principals Committee of the National Security Council, while the heads of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Director of National Intelligence not on that Principals Committee anymore. He writes, quoting, "This is looking very much like the Bannon Regency." Is that going too far?
I think that's going too far, but it was unusual that Steve Bannon was put on the National Security Council and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon and the chief intelligence officer in the administration there. They were given a reduced role. I had a little trouble swallowing that one. We'll see what happens. But, you know, there is this phenomenon that the press is always looking for. I'm always looking for it, too, to find the guy who you can say is the de facto president. That's what the New York Times in an editorial today called him, Steve Bannon. You know, it was, remember when Dick Cheney was really running the George W. Bush White House and what's her name from Chicago was, she was the secret power.
Valerie
behind,
Jarrett, I think.
Yeah, Valerie Jarrett behind Barack Obama. There's always somebody, and Jim Baker, when he was the White House Chief of Staff, a very good one, but he was really running at the White House and deciding everything. It wasn't really Ronald Reagan. So the press is always looking for somebody like that, and Steve Bannon has been elected.
Whether he is de facto president or not, a lot of people are pointing toward a Bannon-esque tone in Donald Trump's inaugural address. In the foreign policy, we've seen so far very strong with ideas of economic nationalism, border security, worried about immigrants, not just illegal immigrants, maybe legal immigration, maybe special visas for high tech and other companies. Is that fair to say that Donald Trump is on a Bannon-esque line here?
Yeah, but, you know, he was already there before Bannon came in as an advisor in the campaign and now in a very strong role at the White House, apparently. That's just Bannon and Trump agreeing. Look, if you think those are bad policies, I think you have to blame the president and not Bannon. I think most of them are fairly good. But look, Bannon's going to get watched because they have this. Look, I think a big problem with the White House is they don't have a strong chief of staff. You need a strong chief of staff. You need hierarchy. I know that sounds terrible, but hierarchy is what you need. You need somebody who can exert discipline and control things without, you know, squashing the president. And the White House doesn't have that. Reince Priebus is a fine guy, but he's a newcomer to Trump, and he's not been allowed to really exert power there that someone needs. You need a CEO underneath the president.
Now, a Supreme Court nomination accepted tonight. Apparently, two front runners coming into Washington for the final selection. President Trump presenting it in prime time. What are your hopes for this appointment?
Well, look, I don't. I'd like to see a conservative on the bench and in the seat that Justice Scalia had. He died last February, and either one of them would be great. I know a little about both of them. The one who everyone has thought, including people who have talked to Trump, thought that Neil Gorsuch from Colorado, who's a federal appeals court judge, was number one. On the other hand, Tom Hardiman, who's on the appeals court in Pennsylvania, is a guy who I think Trump is bound to like. He comes from a working class background and is supposed to be a very, very likable guy. I know he came in to meet Trump, and he was loaded for bear. He was really prepared. He didn't come in just to chit chat with Trump. He came in to really answer serious questions. So, look, I don't know which one it's going to be, but either one's fine with me.
Briefly, if Democrats filibuster this and they hold firm to that, Republicans would have to effectively end the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees, the so-called nuclear option. Should they do that if that happens?
Well, you know, I'm a little dubious of it, but I suspend, and Mitch McConnell does not want to do it unless he has to. And look, we'll see. I mean, look, it'll be 40, 45 days before the first hearing on whoever the nominee is, because there's this long process of FBI background checks and so on. And then we'll see how he does there and see if there's some Democrats who like him. If you don't have to do it, don't do it.
All right, Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
We've been talking to Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard.
Coming up after the news, as President Trump signs executive orders limiting immigration and refugee resettlement in the United States, we take a look at refugees who have put down roots here in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, state lawmakers are at odds over a manufacturing tax credit that's costing far more than originally expected. We'll hear what's at stake for the state budget.
First, on Friday, President Trump signed an executive order instituting a travel ban on people who come from seven countries with alleged ties to terrorism. The ban was instituted immediately and caused travelers from those countries to be detained or sent back in some cases. This prompted backlash nationwide from citizens and some lawmakers.
The executive action is expected to have a major impact on refugees in particular. In a new piece on WisConText, our next guest took a look at refugees here in Wisconsin, how many there are, where they came from, and the steps they went through to obtain refugee status.
Scott Gordon is an editor and reporter with WisContext, which is a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and the UW Cooperative Extension. He's written several pieces on this issue. You can find a link to his most recent story on the Central Time Facebook page or visit wiscontext.org for more on the topic. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Big picture, what are we looking at in terms of the numbers of refugees coming here to Wisconsin?
So between 2002 and 2016, about 13,000 refugees were resettled in Wisconsin, according to numbers from the State Department. And that's out of almost 900,000 in the United States overall.
And how do we stack up compared to other states in that?
Well, right now, for that time period I mentioned, 2002 to 2016, Wisconsin ranks about 24th in a list of all the states and, the few territories and D.C. that resettle refugees. So, hardly the biggest refugee resettlement state. Of course, California and Texas, there's just more space and more large cities and more resources to help people, trying to start a whole new life.
And refugee and immigrant. Now, those phrases are sometimes in the same executive orders lately, but different laws apply to them. What is a refugee, if you can sort that out for us?
Right. So a refugee, as opposed to other categories of immigrants, is someone who is fleeing conflict or persecution of one kind or another, or the definite threat of persecution. And to gain admittance into the United States as a refugee, one has to undergo a pretty thorough process. And I think that bears kind of reminding people in this whole debate, because a lot of people are kind of talking as if there's no process and we don't know what's going on, and that is flat out false.
Yeah, can you lay out the steps of if someone tries to become a refugee coming from another country, what do they have to go through?
Right. So the first step is that someone applies to the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees. And that's kind of the first vetting step. And according to the UN, less than 1% of the world's overall refugee population even makes it through that first step. And then kind of things are referred to the U.S. or to, other countries that accept refugees. And, in the U.S., there's quite a long process that involves several federal agencies looking into people's backgrounds, people's documentation, gathering biometric data on them, all kinds of things. Something that can take months or for a lot of people, even years. And right now, the way the process works, there is an additional screening step for people from Syria. But it's a pretty extensive vetting process that people go through. And, once someone kind of clears the steps that the federal government puts them through, a resettlement agency, which is technically a private nonprofit that gets federal funding, is kind of in charge of helping them get a new start wherever they end up moving.
Looking closer at who's coming to Wisconsin, obviously you mentioned Syrian refugees. They're in the news a lot.
Right.
In Wisconsin, you think Hmong refugees from Southeast Asia. Neither of those are the top source of refugees. Where are they coming from mostly?
Well, the largest incoming group of refugees since 2002, at least, has been people from Burma in Southeast Asia.
And that's a surprise to me. Reading your piece, I honestly had no clue that that was our biggest source of refugee population in Wisconsin.
Well, to be honest, I kind of didn't until I started reporting on the piece. And, I've read about the crisis in Burma before, but I was surprised to learn just how many refugees from Burma come here, especially considering how much more you hear about, as you said, the Hmong people or people from Somalia or people from Syria.
Tell the story there, because we hear news about Syria. We know about the background of the Vietnam War for Hmong refugees coming here. This is a story that is not front and center in our headlines. What's going on in Burma, a.k.a. Myanmar, depending on who you talk to.
Right. So Burma, for a good while, was part of the British Empire. They sort of treated it as part of India. It became independent in 1948. And all through its history, there has been conflict between different ethnic and religious groups. And, in its modern history, Burma has been politically dominated by Buddhists and by an ethnic majority that are just called Burmans or the Bamar, depending on who's talking. And for a lot of that time, there's essentially been a military dictatorship that has pursued, essentially genocide-like campaigns against various ethnic minorities throughout the country. So it's a country that essentially has several civil wars and several humanitarian crises going on at once.
So members of these different ethnic populations have been applying for refugee status around the world, and some of them are, in addition to being ethnic minorities, are a religious minority in Burma.
That's correct. And, I mean, even a lot of the people in the ethnic majority in Burma are oppressed and seeking to get out. Within the country, there's a whole mix of different people who are Christians or animists or Muslims and are persecuted for one reason or another. And the kind of the array of divisions there is really complex.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about Wisconsin's refugee population. So people from Burma fleeing this complicated series of repressions and different military actions by the government, they end up here in Wisconsin. Do we know why Burmese refugees end up in Wisconsin in particular?
You know, not really. That's a decision that kind of comes down to the resettlement agencies and to the State Department to a certain extent, you know, which basically kind of look at, well, where will people have resources? Where will they maybe be able to find family or jobs or, you know, people who share their language and culture? So it's hard to say. I mean, you know, people from Burma are one of the kind of top five refugee groups entering the U.S. generally. So, I mean, there are a lot of people coming in that need to be placed somewhere. You know, in Wisconsin, the largest refugee resettlement area is, of course, Milwaukee. Not surprising because it's a big city. And after that, actually, the Fox cities are a distant second. So, you know, Oshkosh and Appleton actually settle more refugees than Madison does.
Can you talk about these resettlement agencies? Who are they and what do they do?
Well, they're nonprofit agencies, often religious agencies, you know, Lutheran social services, Jewish social services. And essentially, they, well, first kind of help refugees out with gathering all the paperwork and all the stuff that they need to just get through that vetting process. And then when they arrive in the U.S. and their new place of residence, these agencies connect them with various services, you know, such as help finding housing, help getting a job, you know, help getting just some spending money to get on their feet. And really the long-term goal for all these agencies is to help people become self-sufficient.
And how are Burmese refugees doing in Wisconsin, as far as we know?
Well, it's actually really hard to find a breakdown of, you know, people's financial status or their employment status when it comes to refugees. There has been some concern that even for refugees, refugees from Burma struggle a lot with poverty. You know, in my story, I speak with a UW-Milwaukee professor who worked on a study about that. You know, but there are success stories, people who've, you know, been able to really contribute to the community and get jobs and buy homes. You know, of course, in the whole debate over the refugee ban over this past week and weekend, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, you know, human rights is not a meritocracy. So I think that bears keeping in mind, too.
Is there a concern that this executive order will make it harder for refugees from Burma to end up in the U.S. and in Wisconsin?
There is, and it's something I've been looking into for a follow-up piece. Of course, it doesn't explicitly mention people from Burma or the country of Burma. But one really complicated thing about Burma is that it's a majority Buddhist country, and one of the minorities that's being persecuted there are people in kind of the northwest of the country called the Rohingya people. And those people are largely Muslim. And so I've been talking to people who are kind of trying to sort out how the government will interpret this executive order that they've said is, you know, supposed to make exceptions for religious minorities and that they've explicitly said is supposed to make exceptions for Christians. So people are kind of trying to figure out, well, will they make an exception for Rohingya people because they're religious minorities, or will they try to bar Rohingya people because they're Muslims?
A lot of the conversation about refugees globally is related to the big humanitarian crisis, the civil war in Syria. Do we know how many Syrian refugees have made it here to Wisconsin?
Lots of them have come to the States. Only a little over 100 people from Syria have been settled in Wisconsin. So they've been the focus of a lot of public discussion, and including a lot of Governor Scott Walker's discussion of refugees. But it's a pretty tiny number of people compared to people coming from Burma, Laos, Somalia, Iraq, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
And you mentioned the extensive vetting process that already exists for refugees, and Syrian refugees in the U.S. have already faced extra steps along the way?
That's correct.
So what are some of the latest trends? We know in that longer period you mentioned Burmese refugees, the greatest number. What are the changes we're seeing in the more recent years?
Well, the Syrian refugees who've been coming here have only been coming here since about 2014, and that may or may not step up. Of course, it's very uncertain right now, but, you know, in recent years, the Obama administration had really set a goal of bringing in a lot more people from Syria. We do see still a lot of people coming in from Laos and from Somalia. You know, people who are already resettled here have a process that they can go through to get reunited with their families. So it kind of makes sense that once a refugee community is already kind of well established in a place, that you'll see it continue to grow for a bit. Of course, Somalia and Iraq are both targets of the ban. So it's really not clear what's going to happen to people from those countries, how this will affect, you know, the family reunification process. There's just a great deal of uncertainty surrounding all this right now.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is an editor and reporter with WisContext. You can find a link to his most recent story on refugees in Wisconsin on the Central Time Facebook page or visit wiscontext.org for more. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we find out why sales of the George Orwell novel 1984 soared in the last week.
First, a state manufacturing tax credit is costing substantially more than originally expected. The latest figure from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau puts the cost at $1.4 billion by mid-2019. When the credit first passed in 2011, the projected cost was $128 million a year.
Democrats are arguing that it puts too much pressure on other parts of the state's already stretched budget, but Republicans are standing by the manufacturing income tax credit as good for business.
Gordon Hintz joins us now. He's a Democrat representing Oshkosh in the state assembly. Representative Hintz, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, with this new info on the manufacturing tax credit, what concerns do you have about the numbers you're seeing?
Well, look, this is something that we've known about for some time, and really it is about, you know, highlighting how some of the past priorities, I mean, this decision was made in 2011 with no public hearing, with very little input in a last-minute budget decision, and it is something that continues to cost the state an excessive amount of revenue with very little benefit. And so as we head into the next budget, we see these numbers that, you know, by the time the next budget's done, it will have cost the state $1.4 billion. And, you know, there's no, you know, requirement to have any job creation or job growth. And it's really something that explains why we've had to cut funding for K-12 education in the UW system despite, you know, a moderately growing economy.
We'll talk about the impact of this law on business in a minute and jobs, but talk about what you see as better uses for that money than these tax credits.
Well, public education, for one. Again, the original forecast at the time this was passed was it would cost $128 million. You know, it has now cost more than three times that. I guess the problem that I have is, you know, I certainly support targeted tax cuts aimed at, you know, increasing consumer spending or tied to job creation in any way. The way they have done this just, you know, eliminates tax liability. And when you look at the distribution of that money, it disproportionately goes to high income earners with no requirement for any jobs to be, you know, created. So it's a very inefficient use of an awful lot of money that could be used for a lot of our programs that we know benefit the state in the long run.
Well, the idea here, and Republicans would say, hey, this is money, even if it's going to wealthier Wisconsinites and businesses, that's money that they are maybe reinvesting in business here in Wisconsin. And we've got low unemployment rates, very low unemployment rates compared to the national average, compared to Wisconsin history. So maybe it's working.
Well, we've got low unemployment, but we've got rather sluggish job growth. If someone can explain to me that spending $1.4 billion to have the eighth best job growth in the Midwest over the last 5 years, you know, and one of the worst, you know, a little more than half the national rate of growth, you know, doesn't seem to be too effective from a measurement standpoint.
If this could be refined, if this could be targeted, could you get behind this? If the same kind of money was going out there, but with some kind of job creation standard, could you get behind something like that?
Sure. I mean, look, if this was an effective program, I don't think we would have a problem with it. And when Democrats were in the majority, you know, we did deals that were, contingent on job creation, especially with Mercury Marine and an Oshkosh Corp in my area, largely to help them add jobs or save jobs. But with having no requirement, and if you look at the paltry growth that has occurred, you do need, I think, that kind of requirement if you're going to get, you know, compliance. I mean, no one is going to reinvest in their business or add employees if there isn't demand for whatever there is producing. And so, you know, just cutting taxes alone, you know, doesn't increase, you know, demand for their product. And, you know, they will reinvest in it if they can make more money than they're going to benefit from the tax cut. But I'm surprised that there are so many so-called market conservatives that are following something that clearly ignores how the market works.
Talking to Representative Gordon Hintz, he represents Oshkosh in the state assembly, looking at new numbers on a tax credit here in Wisconsin, targeting manufacturing and agriculture for the most part. He says we're paying a lot of money, not getting a lot of jobs out of that. Do you have any hope of making a change in this, given the makeup of the legislature? Your party is in the minority everywhere it counts.
You know, not really. You know, last year on finance, we made several motions, not even to eliminate the credit or repeal it, but simply to delay its full implementation. It didn't hit its full, you know, elimination of people's tax liability until this year. And we just said, look, you know, we are cutting the EW system by $250 million. We're not putting any money into K-12 education, you know, even though we have more revenue, but we're losing it due to this excessive tax cut that costs three times the amount that it was originally forecasted to cost. And, you know, these guys are kind of doubling down on, you know, their ideological perspective on things, but it really is about budget priorities. And instead of paying for public education and instead of investing in the UW system, it was a bigger priority to give a tax cut to largely the wealthiest individuals in the state of Wisconsin.
Governor Walker has said his new budget coming out next month will include restoring some funding to K-12 education, possibly to the university system, focus on rural schools when it comes to education. Is that possible? We could do both, bring back that funding and keep this tax credit?
Well, Governor Walker is definitely one of those rare politicians. You know, he spends 6 years prioritizing tax cuts for the wealthy, dismantling public education in the UW system, and now it looks like with this budget, he's going to run on partially restoring those funding cuts, you know, as if he's some sort of hero. You know, there is revenue to start restoring some of those cuts, but I'm hopeful that people will remember the fact that here's a guy who is now trying to fix the problems that he largely created in our state.
Do you see this being an issue? I know elections just happened. Nobody wants to talk about another round of election, but legislature elections coming up next year, governor up for re-election if he chooses to do so. Is this issue, tax cuts versus investment in education, something that would be at the top of a Democratic Party platform?
Well, you have to be careful when you say tax cuts, because I think if we had done tax cuts in a way that would have put more money in people's pockets to have more disposable income, or if we had done business tax cuts that would have rewarded investment more in their capital or in job creation, it would be something else. The question for people is, do we think giving 11 people who earn over $30 million a year, $22 million of tax cuts, is the best investment of money? Or should we prioritize things like public education and the UW system that have a multiplying factor that invested long-term opportunity and economic growth? And so I think, you know, part of it is looking back at what has been done to our state, what the priorities have been. And in this case, it certainly wasn't our children, our public education system, or our UW system.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Hintz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Gordon Hintz, a Democrat representing Oshkosh in the state assembly. He joined us to talk about the Wisconsin manufacturing tax credit and the impact it's having on the state budget.
President Donald Trump is expected to make an announcement about his nomination for Supreme Court Justice tonight at 7, and you can hear that announcement live on the Ideas Network. We'll have special coverage of the event along with analysis from our NPR political team. That's President Trump's Supreme Court announcement tonight at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network.
And you can hear more tomorrow on the Ideas Network on the Joy Cardine Show and here on Central Time.
There aren't necessarily a lot of things that unite people across the partisan divide, but this week's Super Bowl may be one of them. Looks like there's bipartisan agreement that most people want the New England Patriots to lose to the Atlanta Falcons.
According to a new survey from Public Policy Polling, 53% of people want the Falcons to win, compared to only 27% rooting for the Patriots. And that's consistent pretty much across party lines, with a substantial leaning toward Atlanta for Democrats and Republicans and independents.
Survey does not get into possible reasons, but maybe people want somebody new. By our count, the Patriots have made it into the Super Bowl 6 times since 2004 and won 3 of those times. The Falcons haven't made it to the big game since 1999, when they lost in their only Super Bowl appearance.
I am leaning toward Atlanta, partly for that reason that, New England's been there, they've done it. Partly because I'm not sure why I don't like the coach, Bill Belichick of New England. I have no strong reason for that. And since Atlanta beat Green Bay so badly, it looks better if they go on to win the Super Bowl. Like the Packers, if they lose to the Super Bowl champion, takes a little of the sting out of it.
There was some good news in the survey for the Packers. They tied with the Dallas Cowboys as the favorite team, according to the survey.
Yeah, I like the part where it's the Packers. The part where it's the Cowboys, I could do without. But hey, there's always next year's polls. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.